Kia ora, and welcome to tonight's webinar on gender-affirming healthcare in rural New Zealand. I'd like to welcome and thank Jennifer Shields for presenting to us tonight. She is healthcare lead at Qtopia and president of the Professional Association for Transgender Health Aotearoa. She was an author on the Aotearoa's Primary Care Gender-Affirming Hormone Therapy Guidelines and is currently leading a national training program for Aotearoa's primary care workforce around gender diversity and gender-affirming care. Tonight's session has been endorsed by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners for 1 hour of CME and supported by the Section of Rural Health, Department of General Practice at the University of Otago, and of course, the Division of Rural Hospital Medicine. Tonight's session will certainly be enhanced with your interaction. Jen and I have been discussing how no question is a silly question, and we recognise that this area of healthcare can create some uncertainty and therefore questions. This is a very safe space to ask these questions. I am also grateful for Ralston to be supporting us today and fielding those questions through the chat. So without any further ado, I will hand over to Jen. Thanks, Jen.
Kia ora. Thank you, Lucinda, and welcome everyone. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. Yes, I am healthcare lead at Qtopia and the president of PATHIR, the Professional Association for Trans Health Aotearoa. So if you haven't heard of us, Qtopia, we're a rainbow social support service based down here in Ōtautahi, Christchurch, where I'm calling in from tonight. We offer peer support directly to our communities. We run social support groups throughout the year and events throughout the year, as well as professional development across a number of sectors, but with a particular focus in health. And PATHIR, the Professional Association for Trans Health Aotearoa, is a multidisciplinary professional network of people all over the country working on trans and non-binary health and well-being. So that includes clinicians, including GPs, mental health specialists, endocrinologists, surgeons, the whole spectrum. It includes peer support workers, community workers, social workers, advocates, researchers, really anyone who is working in some form on trans health and well-being is welcome to be a member. Jointly, Qtopia and PATHIR are running this national training program at the moment, which is where most of these slides have come from. The training program is split across three different courses, and tonight mostly draws from the foundation course, which was really for everyone in primary care and focuses on some practical skills for the whole workforce. It's pretty applicable to anyone working in health beyond primary care as well. And so we'll focus today mostly on that, but we also have a clinical skills course available and a particular course for GPs and nurse practitioners and other clinicians interested in prescribing gender-affirming hormone therapy in adults to primary care. So we've got some time, I'll touch on that a little bit as well. But all of these are available both in person and virtually online, either through webinars like this or e-learnings. And we have the budget to come and travel. So if you are interested in a session like this for your practice or your region, my contact details are at the end, and I'm more than happy to have a chat and come visit. I love traveling. It's a nice bonus of the work. So give me a good excuse to come visit.
Perfect.
Key takeaways for today are really just knowing how to provide really excellent care to trans and non-binary patients, understanding why this community faces such disparities, and be able to contribute to trans and non-binary people in Aotearoa living excellent lives. So, touching on some background and history, gender diversity here in Aotearoa and into Ao Māori pre-colonisation, we know that diversity when it comes to sexuality and gender has existed all across the world for generations, and that was true here in Aotearoa as well. So this quote, "Taka tāpoi are part of the whānau, always have been, always will be," comes from a resource developed by Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri called "Taka tāpoi, Part of the Whānau." And taka tāpoi is one of the few kōpua words that we have that predates colonisation that talks about diversity when it comes to sexuality and gender. That diversity was a really accepted part of traditional Māori society. But of course, when we introduced the British legal system here in Aotearoa, we also introduced the norms of Britain at the time. And obviously, homosexuality was criminalised. So we introduced that approach here too. And it's in pretty living memory for most of our community that was decriminalized only in the 70s. So we have come a long way, but we still have work to do. And I think that all of us working in health have a really pivotal role to play in supporting these identities and undoing some of those histories of hurt too. So we're really privileged in this work to be able to work with this framework, Te Whare Taka Tāpoi, which is developed by Elizabeth Kerikeri. That kind of draws on and extends Te Whare Tapa, but as a model of health and well-being specific to Taka Tāpoi, rainbow, gender diverse identities here in Aotearoa, Māori and Tau Iwi alike, and draws on these six values. The way Elizabeth describes this framework, she describes Te Whare Taka Tāpoi as a physical whare that once existed where our communities could be safe and nurtured and look after ourselves and those around us, but through the process of colonization, that whare has fallen into disrepair. So these six values are the ways that we can build up that whare back into our practice. So these might be pretty familiar to lots of us, but you might notice throughout the session today, at the top right of the screen, slides will be tagged with one of these values is how it relates back to. I think the most significant one for me in this work is the value of whakapapa or genealogy, but in this context also means like everything we bring into the interactions we have with our clinicians and our patients, the barriers we've faced, the challenges we might have experienced in our lives, the joy that we've experienced in our lives, all of these different things that bring us into this space together today, both as patients and as clinicians as well. And it's through understanding that whakapapa and that history that we can practice in a really safe way. So, just like Lucinda said, what's most important to me is that everyone here feels safe and able to ask all of their questions. The last thing I want is for people to go away thinking, oh, I really wish I had asked that. So, truly, there's no such thing as a dumb question or a silly question. There's nothing too out there. I get paid to answer your questions. It's one of my favorite parts of the job. So, please feel free to make use of it. Don't worry about knowing the right way to ask or getting the language right. So I know that can be tricky, but we'll just all be here in good faith together today. And if you don't feel putting something in the chat, feel free to put it to me directly and I can see that. Or my contact details are at the end. So if you've got a really burning question you'd rather ask directly, feel free to flick it through. But I have the chat in the corner of my screen, so I should be able to see it throughout. So when it comes to some of the data and what we know, we now have some data from the most recent census, which is really exciting. So as at 2023, 0.7% of adults, or at least 0.7% of adults in Aotearoa identify as trans or non-binary, which is really excellent to have that in hard data. I say at least because we know that some people don't feel as comfortable answering that question in a census, and there are lots of reasons why that might be true. So that's likely a little bit of an undercount, but really great to have that hard data. What we see in other surveys and internationally is certainly an increasing rate of people identifying as trans, non-binary, or gender diverse, including 2% of people in Aotearoa from a 2023 Ipsos survey. And we're seeing that increase over time, and particularly is higher amongst the younger generation. And that makes sense to me. We've had this increase in visibility and acceptance, and more people have access to the language to describe these identities, to understand themselves. And more parents and families have an understanding about gender diversity already, so more comfortable to be open with that with their young people. There's a really excellent graph that I always go to put in a slide and then forget that shows the rates of left-handedness in the population. And for a long time, it was really low because we told everyone they had to write with their right hands. And then we stopped doing that. And all of a sudden, it shot up really quickly over the course of a couple of decades. And then it leveled out at the natural rate of left-handedness in the population. And that's what we're seeing with rainbow identities and with gender diversity as well, is that for a long time, it was. And still is in many places, but for a long time was really difficult to be openly trans or non-binary, and now it is getting easier. We have access to that language, so more and more people feel able to do, which is great to see. When it comes to health and well-being, for a really long time, access to gender-affirming care in particular included a whole lot of barriers. It's what we would describe as a gatekeeping model for lots of people in our community in living memory. As an adult, to access gender-affirming hormone therapy, you would first have to undergo what they called 1 year of real life experience, where you lived as your gender for a year without any medical intervention before you could access any healthcare. And 20, 30 years ago, that was really impossible for a lot of people. It would have meant really challenging conversations with family and friends. For some people, it would have meant losing their family, losing their friends, losing their jobs. There's a whole generation of people who felt that the best way to do that was to move to a new town and start totally fresh, where no one kind of knew their background. And then after that year, it was a psychiatrist, then a psychologist assessment. So lots of barriers, lots of process to get through. And what we're seeing internationally is a move to a more accessible, informed consent-based model of care for adults in particular. And we're starting to move that way here in Aotearoa as well. Recognizing that gender diversity is just another way that humans can be diverse. It's not a pathology. It's not that there's anything wrong with us. It's just another facet of human experience. And really interestingly, what we've seen here in Waitaha in the last kind of 2 years since we've moved to this informed consent process is that all of a sudden the demographic of people accessing this healthcare amongst our specialist GP practices went from probably spiking around mid-20s to all of a sudden having another big jump, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond coming out and accessing this care for the first time. And for many of them, they had started to explore that pathway back when there was a year of real life experience and just went, I can't do that. I can't lose my family. And now have heard that they can just go talk to their GP about it, which is really excellent to see.
And that.
So some of the best data we have comes from this survey series here from Aotearoa, carried out at the University of Waikato, first in 2018, and we're just about to get some survey data from 2022, which is really exciting. It's called Counting Ourselves. In 2018, they surveyed just over 1,100 trans and non-binary people around Aotearoa, and it had a really big health and well-being focus, which was really useful for us. One of the big, almost surprise takeaways for us in the community was this demographic finding. So we found in 2018 that non-binary people made up 45% of the gender diverse population. So that's people who don't feel like they strictly identify with man or woman or masculine or feminine. They might sit somewhere between the two or closer to the one or closer to the other or outside of this kind of gendered binary altogether. And we knew this identity was certainly a significant portion of the community at the time, but I don't think any of us quite expected it to be the majority, which was really interesting to see. And it just means that if we're working with trans communities and rainbow communities, we can't necessarily assume that all of our patients will have a binary identity. And certainly pronouns like they, them becoming more and more common. And we see that reflected in our patient management softwares as well. So some of the key takeaways from counting ourselves, really high levels of participants wanting but not able to access gender-affirming healthcare in particular. And certainly we see that level of unmet need tends to trend higher in rural regions outside of specialist centres where care is provided. The biggest barriers to accessing that were not knowing where to go, having to pay out of pocket to access it, or having to travel pretty extensively to access care. And when we're talking about gender-affirming healthcare, we're talking about a number of different things. It's gender-affirming hormone therapy, it can be surgical interventions, it can be speech and language therapy, hair removal, lots of different things that can make up that gender-affirming healthcare. The really big finding for us, and one of the big reasons why we're doing this work now, is that second one. So 36% of participants had avoided seeing a doctor at all because they were worried about being disrespected or mistreated. So it's just over a third of this community who aren't accessing healthcare when they need it because they worry about how they might be treated when they walk in the door, which is pretty
Jen,
concerning. Sorry, go Lucinda.
did you then do any qualitative, or did they do any qualitative? Was that generally because that's what they'd experienced in the past, and then that was the ongoing fear, or did anyone
Yeah.
explore it further?
It was a bit of a mix. It was some people's own previous negative experiences. It was the anticipation of negative experiences. It was hearing from other community members about their own experiences. So it's a tight-knit community that talks a lot, for better or worse. I think in some ways that's really helpful, in some ways can be quite damaging. Yeah, but it's a quite a complicated, nebulous thing as to, yeah, where that's coming from.
And it'll be interesting to see with the 2022 data if that's changing. Because I'd like to think that hopefully the are we seeing that there's less negative experiences in terms of disrespect and being mistreated and things? Is that a
Yeah,
trend
hard to
or?
say. I can't speak to the 2022 data yet, sadly. I think it's coming in February. I'm hopeful. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that's tracked over time, especially because I think that's quite an easy thing to address. And it's a big part of what we touch on today is if we're thinking about how we can address that barrier about people not coming in because they're worried about how they'll be treated, it's all about that visibility side of things and how we can reassure people from the outside of our service that it's a safe space for them to be in. And we've got some good tips towards the end of that too.
Yeah, great.
But that's obviously a really concerning stat because we know it's a community that has some really particular health and well-being needs, right? So Counting Ourselves also found that 71% of participants aged 15 and older reported high or very high levels of psychological distress, compared with only 8% of the general population, so about 9 times the rate. We know that it's a community that's overrepresented in these health outcomes around mental health and suicide, as well as substance abuse, self-harm, homelessness. So if it's a community with this particular needs and we're not seeing them in their in our practices, that's where that barrier can come into play.
Absolutely.
Thankfully, the research is also identifying some really great protective factors. So Counting Ourselves found that participants who were supported by at least half of their whānau were almost half as likely to have attempted suicide in the last 12 months. So family support is a number one protective factor. And whenever we're working with trans people in our practice, in our work, we're always trying to get family on board as much as we can because we know that's the number one protective factor. And we see that reflected in the international data too. So these three studies, I think, are like the three pieces of the puzzle when we're talking about trans health and well-being. So that first one from 2016 is a study that looks at a group of trans children who are supported in their identities. So a group of trans kids who had come out to their families and said, "Hey, this is who I am." And their families had said, "Yep, we see you. We support you for who you are." And they'd supported their kids in what we call their social transition. So things like changing their name, changing their pronoun, getting a new hairstyle, new wardrobe, all the things that are pretty easy to change and easy to change again down the line if it turns out to not be right. We're not talking about medical interventions, these group, it's just the social stuff. And just being able to be who we are and having that support from our families, their rates of depression and anxiety drop back to being on par with the general population. So that's a really significant impact from a relatively simple intervention. Second piece of the puzzle, language. That study comes from 2018 and again looks at a group of trans young people and checked in with them about whether their name and pronoun was used correctly across 4 different contexts. So they asked about home, work, school, and with their friends and their social life, and found that just one of those places getting that language right resulted in a reduction of suicidal behavior of 56%, which is really significant. And even though that study didn't look specifically at kind of healthcare environments, we can assume that the more places in a young person's life that gets that, the better, and it will have more of an impact than we might imagine. And actually, probably one person getting that stuff right is going to have more of an impact than we might imagine too. So language can feel like a pretty small thing, and it is something that takes a bit of practice and time getting used to, but I think it's one of the things that's really worth putting some effort into because it does have a really significant impact.
I think we come and talk about language a bit later on, don't we? Because I
Absolutely.
certainly know for me, like that was one of the things, and I'm keen to talk about some of the wording around how to make it more feel natural. So we'll come back to it. But there's two very simple things in terms of helping, isn't there, in terms of encouraging the increase of support in your team. Like often we'll have one-on-one, don't we, in our as clinicians in our rooms and trying to get whānau or family on board. That can be one way we can certainly help. And then names. Perfect.
Yeah, has a really big impact. So that third study, quite new from 2023, looks at gender-affirming healthcare specifically. And it's a really interesting study design because they've found a way to do a randomized controlled trial, which is tricky with gender-affirming healthcare interventions. It's from a gender service in Melbourne. And the way they designed it is that their service has about a 12-week wait just as per standard. So they had their control group just go through the regular process, wait for 12 weeks before they had their first assessment and everything. But the experimental group were bumped to the top of the list, so they didn't have to wait that 12-week period. And what they found is that those people who had prompt access to gender-affirming hormone therapy had really significant reduction in suicidality and decreases in gender dysphoria and depression as well. So medical interventions aren't a part of everyone's journey or everyone's transition. We've often thought of it as a very linear, pretty standard process where everyone does the same thing one after the other, but it's much more like a buffet where you can pick and choose what feels best and right for you when. So some people never access medical interventions, and that's perfectly fine. Some people might never change their name. That's perfectly fine. That's one of the, I think, the big takeaways is that everyone's journey is unique and individual, and everyone does things in a different way that feels right for them, and that's perfectly fine. So I always talk about those three studies in particular because they make it really clear to me that these health and well-being outcomes that we see in this community aren't inherent to being trans or non-binary. They're a result of what we know as minority stress, or that additional stress or additional barriers people face as they move through the world. And there's no reason why a trans person in Aotearoa can't live just as happy and full and rich a life as anyone else. It's just these kind of additional barriers and additional stresses and stigmas that tend to be on them that lead to these health outcomes, which means that they're addressable, which is really good for us. The other reason I talk about these three pieces of research is that this topic is a really politically loaded one at the moment. Unfortunately, there's a lot of incorrect information about gender diversity and gender affirming care out there at the moment, which can make doing this work really challenging. So you will almost definitely come across some incorrect information out there. You might have someone send things to you being like, "Oh, you have to read this. I found this on Facebook. This is really important." But what's most important is that we keep coming back to what we know to be true, what we can see in the peer-reviewed evidence base, what I get to see in the communities and the families that I work alongside, what the clinicians I work with see amongst their patients and in their clinical experience. It's really clear that being affirmed in our genders, having that support from our whānau, being able to access gender-affirming healthcare and mental health support when we need it is saving lives. So that's what I keep on coming back to. No matter what my auntie sends me on Facebook at 2 in the morning, I just put it to the side of my mind and keep on coming back. I know to be true.
Auntie, yes.
So, coming to language and terms, I'll send a copy of these slides through. So, don't feel like you have to memorize everything. I think the most important part about language is that you don't have to be an expert and you don't have to know everything, right? It's perfectly fine if someone shares something with you and you're like, "Oh my God, I've never heard that before in my life." Don't worry, because it happens to me at least once a month, and this is my day job. I think a really useful follow-up question, 100% of the time, is something like, "Tell me about what that means for you." Because even if you've heard a term before, two people who use the same word to describe themselves might still have really different experiences. So being able to say something like, "Thanks so much for sharing. Tell me about what that means for you," lets them share in as much or as little detail relevant to the conversation that you're having, and helps you understand the person in front of you a bit more rather than just the label or the identity.
Jenny, if you have a hunch, an intuition that there may be some gender diversity, but it's not documented or hasn't been labelled anywhere, how can you bring that up if you're wondering if that's a component of what's going on and the patient hasn't voiced it yet? What's a safe way to bring it up or a good phrase to use? Because that's one of my, I don't want to put my foot in it, so you know, like you say, I know there's no quite right way to do it, but what's a safe or a courteous way to say it potentially?
Yeah, I think there are lots of sneaky ways to do it by building it into your systems. So often when I'm meeting someone for the first time or I'm doing a session like this, I'll say, "Kia ora, my name's Jen, my pronouns are she and her." And sharing your own pronouns is a little like indicator that you have some understanding around this, that you might be a safe person to share that to. You can build that into your practices if you're seeing someone for the first time after a little bit, saying, "Kia ora, so nice to see you again. Is this the name you're using at the moment? Are these the pronouns you'd like to use today? Just let me know if that ever changes." And if someone calls you on it, you can just say, "Oh, we're asking that for everyone. It's just our standard process at the moment." Things like that. Little visible signals in your consult room can be really helpful too. So I've got some posters at the end as an example, but things like that are often the visual trigger that can get people to share. But beyond all of those things, I think it's perfectly fine to say something like, just so you know, if you ever wanted to share anything with me about your gender or your sexuality, I need you to know that this is a safe place to do that. And just giving them the reassurance that if they wanted to talk about it, they could.
Brilliant. Thank you.
LGBTQIA plus is the acronym that shifts and grows on a regular basis. You'll see lots of different versions of it. You'll see, shorter and longer versions all the time. Most important part about that acronym is the plus on the end, because that really means we're including everyone, even if we haven't included a particular letter. So if all you can manage is LGBT, kapai, chuck the plus on the end and you're all set. The letters in there refer to a lesbian, so a woman who's attracted to other women. Gay, which previously has been pretty gendered, so a man who's attracted to other men, but is a bit more of an umbrella term now. Gay women use the term all the time too, but generally means same sex attracted. Bisexual, attracted to two or more genders. Transgender, someone whose gender is different from the sex they're presumed to be at birth. Queer, which is a bit of a sticky word with a really long history, but that's, I think, the most important thing to know is that some people really don't like it, some people do. For lots of different reasons. Everyone's allowed to use the words they feel best to describe themselves, and we'll respect those choices. But it's not a word that I would use to proactively describe someone, especially in a professional context, unless I'd heard them use it for themselves first or I checked in with them about it. Questioning is someone who's just figuring it out. Intersex refers to variations in sex characteristics. Asexual is a spectrum in which people sit where they might not experience sexual attraction in the same way a lot of us do. And then ally is like a champion, a supporter, a friend of the community. There are other terms out there. We'll almost definitely come across new ones or ones that aren't on this list. So again, I think it's perfectly fine to admit to not knowing something. It's perfectly fine to say, thanks so much for sharing that with me. I haven't heard that one before. Do you mind telling me a bit about what that means for you and letting them share that in? And I think it's much more reassuring to have a clinician ask about something rather than maybe just pretend like we totally know what they meant and bluff our way through it. MVP
Yeah.
FAF is an acronym for a whole host of Pacifica identities. So just like here in Aotearoa, all around the Pacific, diversity in terms of sexuality and gender has existed for generations and generations. So particularly if you're working in communities that have quite high Pacifica populations, you might come across some of these. Many of these have continued to be a really integral part of the community for generations. So lots of different experiences in there too. And Rainbow Community is just a nice, easy shorthand for the LGBTQIA plus community that does include everyone. It's pretty safe and accepted, especially in health and education here in Aotearoa. So it's a nice fallback to come back to. Heteronormativity, when we're talking about heteronormativity, we're talking about this belief or assumption that everyone in the world falls into these two genders and gender roles in life and that everyone's heterosexual. It's really prevalent. I think department stores are maybe the easiest example to see it. If you picture yourself walking into the warehouse or Kmart and you're passing the kids' clothes, girls' clothes, a lot of them are going to be pink. Boys' clothes, a lot of them are going to be blue. Toys are the worst for it. Girls' toys tend to be Barbies, princess, homemaking dolls. Boys' toys tend to be trucks, Lego, adventure, outdoor. That's what we're talking about when we talk about heterosexuality. This idea that heteronormativity, the idea that in all the world you've got two options, one likes pink, one likes blue, one wants to stay home and have babies, one wants to go out and drive a truck. They love each other. That's the only option anyone has. If that doesn't describe who you are, well, you're a bit shit out of luck. So that's really talking about the gender binary, just the acknowledgement of these two genders, men and women, and nothing else. And it's pretty, I don't know, obvious to me at least that this really restrictive idea of this is a woman, this is a man, doesn't describe probably most of us on this call, right? We're much richer and fuller than this really limited and stereotypical understanding of what that looks like. So much more, we talk about the gender spectrum. The whole range of gender identities that might sit between and outside of male and female. Like I said earlier, some people will sit closer to the one, closer to the other. Other people will feel like they sit outside of that spectrum altogether. most important thing is that we're not getting rid of men and women, pink and blue, boys and girls, not getting rid of heterosexuality. We are here to just make more room for everyone to feel like they can be who they are without feeling like they have to restrict themselves to put themselves in a box. So making room, more room between those identities, but also within those identities as well, and really expanding just the ability to be who we are.
I like that.
So when we're talking about gender, we're talking about a few different interrelating concepts. So gender identity is your personal sense of your own gender that can correlate or match with your presumed sex at birth or differ from it. Everyone has a gender identity. That's something that's really felt. Gender expression is the stuff that's on the outside. So our clothes, our appearance, our hairstyle, our body language, all of these things are tools that we can use to communicate that internal identity to the outside world. Sex is like the clinical stuff, the physical parts of our bodies that we think of as either male or female that we're presumed to be at birth. And sexuality is the way people then experience and express sexual attraction. So the important thing to understand about those four concepts is that they are all connected and interrelated, but they don't necessarily always match or translate into each other, right? So someone's sex isn't always the same as their gender identity. Myself, I'm a trans woman, so when I was born, the whole world thought I was a boy, and so did I for about 17 years. But my gender is a woman. Someone's gender identity doesn't always match their gender expression, so it's pretty common for lots of trans folks to take some time when they first come out for that external expression to match that internal identity for lots of reasons, comfort, safety. But we're also seeing more and more now people feeling like they don't have to have an external gender expression that matches or is coherent because all of those things are socially constructed, right? Like clothes, the way we gender clothes changes really quickly through fashion, and it's the same for other things too. And then sexuality sits alongside those altogether. So someone can be trans or non-binary and also be gay, straight, bisexual, etc. Gender is about who we are, and sexuality is about who we're attracted to or who we're in relationships with. So knowing that someone is trans or non-binary doesn't tell you anything about their sexuality. So cis or cisgender is the word that we use for someone whose gender is the same as the sex they're presumed to be at birth. Trans, transgender, someone whose gender is different from the sex they're presumed to be at birth. We use those two words the same way we do gay, straight, homosexual, heterosexual, just to avoid having to call one trans and the other normal, kind of getting away from that language of normal. And then your personal pronoun is the pronoun a person uses to identify their gender, like she, he, or they. Sometimes we can get stuck on calling one person they because we're used to it as a plural. But we use it in the singular all the time, and we don't know who we're referring to. This is where my workshop script starts to get messy because we're usually all in a room together, and I talk about someone leaving a phone behind at the table. But you would also use it like if you were expecting a package to arrive, and you might say something like, "Oh, I really hope the courier comes today. I hope they get here soon." It would be pretty clunky to say, "I hope he or she gets here soon." You'd pretty naturally
Yeah,
say in that,
absolutely. That's
right?
what I say to people too. How do you say the MX? Do you say MX?
Yeah. So MX is like a like the gender neutral version of Mr. or Miss or Mrs. Most people pronounce it like mix or mixta.
Mix.
Yeah, it can be a
Okay.
bit. The other one you might come across is that some people use pronouns that aren't she, he, or they're often called neo pronouns and generally are used by people who are outside of that gender binary. The most common one you might see is AMEA, which is like they, them, their, but without the TH at the front. Just like with everything else about language, it's perfectly fine to say that you don't know something and being able to say something like, "Thanks so much for sharing that with me. Those are new to me. Do you mind giving me an example of how to use them in a sentence?" And I'll do my best to get it right, but might take me some time while I get some practice in. Very sorry if I get it wrong. Just let me know if I do, and I'll correct myself. So gender is what we're talking about when we're talking about trans and gender diverse patients. Sex is the clinical stuff, the stuff that we need to know to be able to provide really good care. We use the term presumed to talk about someone's previous gender they were presumed to be at birth. You might also see assigned at birth. They're pretty interchangeable. Assigned is probably a bit more common. I really presumed, especially after having conversations with quite a few parents of trans kids. It was kind of like a presumption that the parents made, right? Like an assumption that they made on the best information they had in front of them. rather than an active assignment, right? We use terms like that to just acknowledge that kind of history for someone, because it is a part of their history rather than necessarily like a current part of who they are, right? And important to recognize that not everyone will be comfortable identifying themselves as having the sex they're presumed to be at birth. So you might have trans patients come into their practice who aren't open about being trans, or might not openly describe themselves as being assigned male at birth, or presumed male at birth, or biologically male, or whatever language they might like to use. So it just means that we have to get good at being able to ask when we need to. And thankfully, our patient management systems and the NHI is really good at keeping track of all that information so that all the clinically relevant stuff is always still going to be attached to someone's file. So, someone presumed male at birth whose current gender is a woman is a trans woman, same vice versa. Someone presumed female at birth whose current gender is a man is a trans man. And when we're talking about a trans person, we use their current gender and pronouns no matter when we're talking about them. So if I was talking about myself as a 5-year-old, I'd still say Jen, I'd still say she, even though I was using a different name and different pronouns then. And it can feel a little bit clunky for us because we instinctively want to use the name we knew them by then, but it's just the most respectful thing to always use that current language.
Can I just pick up on the NHI PMS system? So, say if you change from their presumed sex at birth to, or gender at birth to, their trans identity now. So, say you've got a trans male who has a cervix still. So, will it retain the need to have a smear on the system? Can we do that?
Yeah, good question. So it varies depending on the patient management software you use. So I think most of them, except MedTech 32, now have really good systems for managing sex and gender as two different fields. It's my understanding that most kind of current and modern patient management systems will be able to do recalls like that, as long as that you've got that kind of sex marked down as what it needs to be, and then the gender is the patient's gender. Yeah, sometimes we are dealing with really clunky systems like MedTech 32. So I know at my practice, the practice I'm enrolled at as a patient before they moved systems, I had an F as a sex marker on my file and just a like a note or an alert written at the bottom of my file that said something like Jennifer doesn't have a cervix, doesn't need a smear. So sometimes we just have to find
Right.
ways to make the systems work for
Manually.
us. Yeah. And sometimes you'll come across like a referral that might need a particular sex or gender marker to be able to be accessed. Like we had a funding for a contraceptive contract that was only available to patients with an F on their file. So some GPs were having to flip their trans men's markers back to F to send the referral off and back again. So just let your patient know what's happening and why, and let someone know because often those things can be fixed.
Okay,
How do
cool.
you go about changing the NHI? Because I had a patient recently who was a trans woman and undergoing a lot of mental health strain because they were having challenges changing the NHI system, which was still labeling them a male. Do you know what the process is? So again, some patient management systems will do it automatically, or you can make them sync with NHI. Otherwise, there's an 0800 number on the slide you can just ring. They've been really clear that for gender diverse patients, you can update those details on the NHI at any time, and there's no requirement for a legal name or gender marker change to be able to do that, which is really great. I would just let people know that just because we update it in the NHI doesn't mean it will go everywhere. Our systems are really bad at talking to each other, so sometimes there'll be bits and pieces that might need to be updated individually. Particularly specialist services can be a bit tricky with things like that, but just letting people know that hopefully once they've got them all sussed and changed, if the NHI has been changed, then that should be the last of it. Yeah, cool. So some of the useful questions, I think it's always helpful to have a bit of a script in your back pocket. These are the things that you might better start to weave into your standard process, or at least with patients you're working with who are part of the community. But saying something like, "Kia ora, so nice to see you again. This is the name I have for you on file. Is that right? Is there another name you'd prefer to use that we should use instead? Would you like us to update our records? What name are you comfortable being called for in the waiting room? Because people might be out in different places at different times. So we certainly have patients who are really happy with one name in the privacy of the consult room, but would prefer a different name to be called in the waiting room, or might would prefer not having a name called out at all. So just making sure that's documented, particularly for the front of house teams as well. And then introducing yourself with your own pronouns is a really nice way, like a soft open to invite people to share their own. But then you could follow up with something like, what pronouns would you like our team for use to use for you? We can add those to your file if you like. Just really recognizing that, like I touched on, everyone's different and has their own preferences, approach, comfort, and terms that they use for themselves and their bodies. And that every transition is an individual journey, and there's no pressure, rush, or expectation to change names or pronouns. People will take their time with it, and that's perfectly fine. And we're really there just to enable that person to make those decisions for themselves and support them through it. So, like I just touched on, people might be out in different places at different times. We often think about coming out as this thing that happens once in your life, and that's that. But actually, people come out constantly. You're often making decisions about who we're open with, about our identities in different spaces. So, it can be quite a full-on process. And like I touched on before, it's pretty common for people to start to come out in a few places at once before coming out everywhere. So often people might start at home and school and at the GP practice, but nowhere else. So just having an awareness of those things and really recognizing that there's no requirement to be out to be able to access gender affirming care at any time. So lots of our older demographics, in particular, the ones who are just now coming out in their kind of 70s and 80s, are actually really happy for that to be a thing that they're doing just for themselves, and they're pretty happy not talking about it with everyone. So we've definitely got patients that we work alongside who are on hormone therapy, but not too fussed about changing their name or changing their appearance otherwise, and that's perfectly fine for them too. When it comes to neurodiversity, we know that trans and non-binary people are about 3 to 6 times as likely than the general population to be autistic. And they also have elevated rates of other neurodevelopmental conditions. That doesn't mean they can't be trans or non-binary, right? So people who are on the spectrum have that autonomy and self-determination just as the rest of us do. Sometimes we might have a genuine concern about capacity to consent, and that's where we would seek additional support. But things like communication barriers or struggling with eye contact aren't a barrier to accessing care as well. And certainly, quite a few of the GPs I work with doing that informed consent process, because some of the steps are pretty information heavy, or do a lot of it via kind of resources and email, where they send the patient home with things to read and then answer questions back and forth through email too. So the number one question, what if I make a mistake? It's perfectly fine. It's all a part of how we learn. We're going to make mistakes. That's fine. Golden three-step process is just apologize, correct yourself, and move on. Oh, so sorry, Jen, and continue on with the conversation. Easy as that. There's no need to make a big deal of it. In fact, I'd recommend not to. Just keep it simple. Apologize, correct yourself, move on. Easy as that. I thought I'd touch briefly on some of the prescribing side of things. The prescriber workshop we deliver follows these primary care guidelines. They were published March last year and are pretty accessible. They were written with the intent of any kind of clinician new to this care could pick them up and have a read through and then come away with a good understanding of the process and considerations. They are specifically for adults in primary care and specifically for hormone therapy. When we start talking about younger people and things like blockers, things get much more complicated. So, just the simple stuff. The process is a staged approach, so follows these steps over a number of appointments. The steps aren't one to one with appointments, so it really varies depending on the patient and how well you know them. Certainly, if you've been doing this for a little bit and you've got a patient you know really well, it could be done in a couple of sessions. Some patients with maybe more needs can take a little bit longer. But a lot of it is about that kind of relationship building and information gathering. And then the hormones themselves are pretty standard medications, which is nice.
It's a definition of adult over 18.
Yes, yeah, these are written for over 18. Yeah. Some pathways around the country vary a little bit. In Canterbury, we've been doing 20 and up for the last couple of years, but that's mostly because when we moved to it, we were aware that if we went straight to 18 right off the bat, our GPs would be flooded with people. So we stepped down slowly. But we're just about to move to 18 now. Yeah.
Okay.
So in terms of why informed consent and why primary care, we see much better outcomes through this informed consent process and being based in primary care. The previous approach of requiring a readiness assessment in the specialist mental health system and then going to endocrinology was pretty inequitable. There were really significant barriers to accessing care. Here in Canterbury, adults with really stable controlled mental health were waiting 18 months to see specialist mental health before they could get started. Like I said, what we see internationally in best practice is that there's no reason why every single trans person needs to go see specialist mental health services to make a decision about their healthcare, you know? We saw a pretty significant unmet need in counting ourselves. And we see really decent barriers and decent improvements in patient mental health through this approach too, which is really great. And just practically speaking, being able to access a GP means that you're going somewhere close to home. You're going somewhere you probably already know and have a relationship with. For you as clinicians, you probably already know the patient. You're there looking after the whole person versus the previous model where you would go see a specialist mental health who are just looking at your kind of gender incapacity to consent and then going to see endocrinology for one appointment to get started. Whereas GP has the ability to look after the whole person, which I think is needed for this community in particular in this kind of care. I'll fly through these a little bit because I'm mindful of the time and there's a bit more important stuff to get to towards the end. But these are some of the quotes from one of the GP practices we work alongside in Wellington from their patient base. It has a really significant positive impact on patients' well-being. And what I hear from all the GPs that I work with is that it's a really rewarding piece of work to be able to do because it's relatively simple and it has such a significant impact as an intervention, which is really nice to see. So the informed consent process is a really collaborative one. The clinician brings their experience and their expertise and the awareness of the systems and medications and risks and benefits and everything to really support the patient to be able to make a decision that's right for them. It doesn't mean prescribing treatment which isn't clinically indicated, and it doesn't mean having to work in isolation. There's always going to be situations where you might need to call out for additional help, but the primary care guidelines are really good at walking through all of those things as well. And this again is from the same practice in Wellington. They developed this to give an overview of what the informed consent process looks like and what it means. So, on the left, you have a clinician bringing their duty of care and their awareness and understanding and expertise. And on the right, you have a patient bringing their own kind of experiences and barriers. And in the middle is that informed consent process, which is that collaborative, shared decision making, that respectful relationship, and the ability to have open conversations, which is really beautiful. So, some of the practical stuff, the top tips, be visible. I think that's the number one thing. And I'll touch a little bit more on that on the next slide. But I think that's probably the number one tool in our kitty for addressing that barrier of people not walking in the door. For thinking about how someone outside of our service could look at it from the outside and know that it's a place that they would be safe, welcomed, accepted for who they are. That's how we get it through. But we do have to back it up with practice. So, we have to also let our actions speak for us. Thinking about some of the systems and processes in our practice, thinking about our patient management software, making sure it's doing what it needs to do, our enrollment forms, making sure the whole team is on board as well, because it's one thing to have a supportive clinician and another thing to have a supportive whole team environment. Make no assumptions. We can't necessarily tell someone's gender when they look at them because their gender expression might not necessarily match. Can't tell someone's sexuality by looking at them. So we just have to get better at not making those assumptions and getting more comfortable with asking when we need to. What we know is that when we make an assumption and it's incorrect, it just puts another barrier between us and the trust we're building with the person in front of us. So we make as few as possible. A really nice shortcut to not making those assumptions is using inclusive language. So the one that trips me up all the time is that I'll be talking to a young person and I'll say something like, mum and dad, even though I know in our community there's lots of mum and mum, dad and dad, just mum, just dad, parents. So even if I'm thinking mum and dad, if I say parents or whānau out loud, then I haven't made the assumption out loud. Same thing for boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. Even if I'm thinking it, if I say partner, I haven't made that assumption out loud. So using inclusive language is a bit of a shortcut and a good practice to get into. Be curious about your own discomfort. We all have unconscious bias. It's a really natural part of being a human being, but it's really important to be able to be mindful of that and address that when it's about people, because that can impact on the work that we do. We tend to experience our own bias as discomfort. We meet someone new or someone says something and we feel a little bit off or unusual, and our natural instinct is to put a bit of distance between us and that feeling. But instead, if we're able to really examine that feeling of discomfort and ask, what's making me feel this way? Why do I feel like this? We can start to untangle what's at play and whether there is some bias we might need to be more mindful of. We tend to have more bias about things that are new or different or outside of our day-to-day. So I think my favorite one on the list is expand the opinions you listen to, because it's the most fun bit of homework. Thinking about what we're watching, what we're reading, what we're listening to, and genuinely the kind of fiction media we consume as well. If we are watching shows on Netflix that have lots of rainbow and trans characters, then it becomes more part of our daily life. So we become more used to it and it becomes less like jarring or different or new, and we don't feel as on the back foot when we're used to it. So the latest season of Heartstopper just came out on Netflix, season three. What I've been recommending for the last 4 years is Heartstopper. I think it's the most beautiful, joyous, true to life. I work with rainbow young people all the time, and I think Heartstopper is probably the most realistic depiction of teenagers at the moment on TV. So if you need something to go watch after this, I would recommend checking out Heartstopper, but seek out that rainbow media and yeah, bring it into your life as well.
I've never
Heartstopper,
heard of
right?
Heartstopper, but I will take that recommendation because I actually really like that. We often talk about identifying our biases and just that concept that I think you've so eloquently described around what makes you feel uncomfortable. That might be just a very easy way to identify an internal bias and in exploring it. So I like that. So, right, Heartstopper, here I come. I don't
Excellent.
watch much TV, but I'll let you know what I think.
It's a good one. It's a good family watch. It's probably age appropriate down to, oh, 10, 12 maybe. Yeah,
Ah,
it's pretty
okay.
nice. Yeah.
Oh, nice. I have three boys, 9, 11, and 13.
Oh.
Boom. Thank you. They love
And
TV.
accept that you got to make mistakes. That's just a part of how we learn, remember? So just correct yourself and apologize when you do. So when it comes to visibility, like I say, I think it's the number one tool we can use to reduce that barrier to access and care. So thinking about what's visible on our services website, we recommend having a little inclusion statement somewhere, something as simple as Kashmir Health is open to our whole community, including Māori, Pacifica, disabled, rainbow, gender diverse clients, etc. And that can seem really obvious, but that kind of really explicit statement would mean that someone who is feeling a little uncertain about coming in might be checking the website and see that you've said explicitly, like, yes, you are welcome here. And that can be the thing that gets them in the door. Same thing with the about page on your website. If you've got staff bios, including your pronouns in there. If you're interested in working with the rainbow community, mention it in the bio too. If you're interested in rainbow health or gender affirming care, you can mention it there. People actually look at those. They do take a look. I know a few years ago now, there was a couple of community members here in Christchurch who went through and looked, hunting through practice websites, looking for one that would mention it, and didn't find so many. So it can be really significant to get people in. And then once they're in the space, thinking about what's in your waiting rooms and consult rooms that might indicate that it's a safe space. So these posters are free to download and print off. We've got some more on our website, things like that, little rainbow flags at the front desk or a sticker on your front door, things like that can help people get in the door. And then when they're in the consult room, if they're still feeling a little bit uncertain, might be the thing that tips them over the edge into sharing something they really needed to. Rainbow lanyards are really popular and pretty easy to get now. If you're ever ordering new staff badges, having a space for pronouns on there, but you can also order pronoun pins pretty cheaply from lots of places now too. And then thinking about the process side of things, making sure our enrollment forms have a space for pronouns and good options for gender as well, and looking at what's in our patient management system too. So these are questions we like to leave people with, these useful things to reflect and put into practice. Thinking about how would someone coming to your service know that it's safe? What could we do better? What can I do to support the community? What can I do to educate those around me? What can I do to advocate for changes within my sphere of influence? And what further resources, information, or help do I need? And with that last one, you're not alone. There are a lot of resources out there. So those primary care guidelines I mentioned are available at PATHA's website, PATHA.nz/guidelines. If you're interested in working with this community or interested in gender affirming care, I think it's really worthwhile to join PATHA. It's pretty affordable. I think it's maybe like $100 a year, if that, 40 maybe. I really should know this off the top of my head, actually. But you get access to a really great community and an email list server of people who are constantly sharing the latest research, asking really interesting questions, connecting people across different parts of the country and building up little peer groups as well. So I think it's really worthwhile. Health pathways, health info, yeah, depends on where you're around the country, but should have information about what's available in your region and how to access it, as well as some patient-facing stuff. And then the Rainbow Support Collective is a network of a whole host of rainbow community organizations around the country. I always think it's really valuable to be connected in with the community organizations that are close to you because they know the community best, they know the community's needs best. So if you aren't already aware of what's close to you, you can reach out to the Rainbow Support Collective and they'll be able to connect you up with someone local to you as well. And then our website is primarycare.qtopia.org.nz, and you can reach me at primarycare@qtopia.org.nz. And I'll flick through a copy of the slides and a bit of a resource pack as well, so that you all have all this information handy as well for after today. But otherwise, thank you so much for spending time with me. I'm so happy to answer questions if anyone has any. I will stop sharing my screen now so I can see everyone.
And obviously, too, because what we'll do, Jen, is we obviously this is being recorded and then we upload it onto our website. So people will be able to see this whole talk. And actually,
Awesome.
and then we also turn it into a YouTube podcast. So lots of people will get a lot of hits in terms of people just listening to it. Thank you. That has been fabulous. I know everyone always wants some a page of medication and everything, but we can always do a follow-up session. So, on behalf of all of us, Jen, thank you very much for your time this evening. The concepts and everything, you just described them so beautifully, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you, Ralston, for coming in as well. And to all of you, we look forward to catching up with you next time. Our next session is on pediatric cardiology at the end of November. So, look forward to seeing you all then. Great.